find your keys?
I did. Good. I did.
How's that student feeling?
Better. It was just a little bit of an emergency, that's all.
Yeah, I heard.
Well, and I wasn't supposed to be the point person, but I ended up being. But it's okay. It's sort of part of living on campus. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about narratives, in particular from the perspective of doctors. Narratives both by doctors and also narratives about doctors as well. To that end, what we're trying to find here is not just a perspective that's different than ones we've read before, but actually it might be just part of a continuation of some of the perspectives we've had. Before we start talking about some of the readings, I want to pass around this little handout which talks a bit about the final day of class we're going to have and also the final assignment everyone has to do for the class. I talked a bit about this earlier in the semester, and certainly I've mentioned it a couple of times throughout, things to tuck away or think about as we gear up and get closer towards working on what your final assignment is going to be. The last class we have, which is 2 weeks from today, is going to be us, as I've said before, sharing our own writing, if you will, related towards clinical practice, clinical thought, or just narratives related toward medicine in some way. It can be autobiographical or not, it can be theoretical, it can be fictional, it can be poetry, it can be whatever the hell you want. My concern is that what you do is provide a piece that really shows originality on your part and investment on the topics that we've been talking about this semester. We've spent week after week being privy to the words, the narratives, the perspectives of so many others that I think what we're going to be doing the last day is sort of stepping up to the plate and sharing a bit of something of our own personally. To that end, it says here in detail what is required of you both on the last day of class, what needs to be shared on the day, how long, how much, what have you, and then what documentation to follow up from that in order to submit to complete the requirements for the course. If you look more closely, I want to read through all this, and then I'll take questions from anybody if you have regarding the assignment. It mentions in this big block here the two parts of the assignment, the in-class reading or presentation, which is going to be 2 weeks from today. Each student will be speaking, you know, roughly 3, 5, 8 minutes, something like that. And I'll get a bit more down the page about what specifically you need to share, but just be thinking about the fact that it's about sort of like the quality of what you can share in a few minutes with the rest of the class versus having to come in and tell a long, protracted sort of story, if you will.
About the paper we're writing, is that it? I just want to make sure I understand.
They're the same thing.
Okay.
Yep. The written portion, the length of that depends upon what kind of genre you're going to be working with. So obviously, if you're going to be using poetry or if you're going to be using some kind of like creative writing that's more economical, then I'm not going to expect you to write 20 or 25 pages or what have you. But if you're writing a traditional paper, if you're writing something that's more journalistic or editorial, something that might be sort of an opinion piece, maybe even something that's just straight up memoir autobiographical, I would like about 15 to 20 pages. And that's based mostly on the fact that this is a graduate level class, and so that's a fair number of pages to ask for. As for if you're going to do something that's more creative or something more poetic or something that uses the visual arts, I have here 8 to 10, but even that's negotiable. You know, I'm going to try to make sure that the amount of time and investment that goes into it is appropriate and consistent across the board rather than the actual page numbers depending on the genre. So if you have a question of whether your paper is long enough or what have you, just ask. You know, more than likely it's probably going to be fine.
Double-spaced? I'm just curious what you're...
Yeah, double-spaced. Double-spaced.
People are very rigid about it.
No, double-spaced, yeah. In general, when you get a page number, it just means double-spaced. So, yep, double-spaced. The written assignment is due on Sunday, May the 8th, which is to say you can submit it in class beforehand, or you can bring it on the day, or you can leave it at the Bioethics Center, or you can email it to me, whatever you want to do. And my email is on here for submission. I'm just going to read through each of these paragraphs just so we can all hear the specifics of the assignment. But no, and if you have any questions, just chime in. Your final assignment for our class will be submitted in two forms, as outlined above, a reading or presentation to be performed on our last day of class, and a piece of writing based on this presentation to be submitted after the final exam. Given that we have spent the semester studying and executing the acts of reading and discussing medical narratives, your final assignment will be to produce an original piece of narrative writing, as prose, poetry, or visual arts. You have complete creative intellectual license to produce any type or manner of text you like. Your only general requirement, aside from the specific ones listed above, is to create a piece of original work that demonstrates your sensitivities and skills as a student of medical narratives. Some genres that you might want to think about writing within include, but are not limited to, fiction, drama, screenplay, poetry, memoir, journalism, editorial, literary analysis, photo documentary, case study, and ethnography. Obviously, your best bet is to pick one, you know, and have that be the genre that you're going to work with, but totally whatever the hell you want to do is fine by me. Your piece may be based on readings from the semester, or it may be inspired by texts from outside the course. It may be autobiographical in nature, or it may be focused on the health concerns of friends, strangers, or general populations. It may be argumentative in tone, or it may inspire nostalgia, sadness, or laughter from your listeners. For the in-class reading presentation of your final assignment, given that it will take place almost 3 weeks before, this is if there was my undergrad class, a final class, consider that earlier version, or the what you present in class, to be a kind of rough draft or abridged version of what you will submit in hard copy by May 8th. In other words, share some of the central prose or ideas or sentiments of your final writing assignment on April 20th, but don't feel obliged to have the entirety of the final piece completed by then. The idea being that 2 weeks from today, we're all meeting for our last class, we're all going to share some writing. So take that as a little bit of an impetus to get started on the final paper, and a little bit of an idea to think about a rough draft or some sentiments or a central core concept that you want to share with the class. Test it out on an audience. Share it with us what you think. But don't feel like by the 20th, 2 weeks from now, you have to know exactly what you're doing your final paper on, or that you've even finished it. No way am I going to expect that of you. So in other words, you know, come in 2 weeks with something started. Lastly, you'll need to submit a 1 to 2 pages of prose alongside your final piece of original writing that explains your methodology in composing this assignment. What was the motivation for your composition? What ideas that we have discussed this semester informed your writing? What kinds of ethical value does your work add to or comment on the discipline of medical narrative studies? In other words, produce that piece of writing, whatever form you want it to be, and then just give me a little bit of an afterword that says, this is what I did, and this is why I did it the way I did. That's pretty much it. Any questions?
No.
No? What's so funny?
Not having done the paper for a long time, that's funny.
Okay, well, this will be good for you then, because you do whatever the hell you want.
Cathartic.
There you are. Okay. Let's start talking about some of the narratives for today. If we could start, let's start with The Art of Healing by Auden. This poem. What we're going to be doing today is sort of talking about this poem by Auden. And it's a poem that's written by him for his friend, David Protech, is listed here, who is a physician. It is a kind of eulogy, a memoriam, if you will, but it really is a kind of assessment, remembrance of the individual as physician and the individual as friend. I'm trying to think about how those two things might actually be synonymous in this case. So this first narrative that we're looking at is poetry, and it's going to be about us thinking about an individual, thinking about a doctor. In the middle of the class today, we're going to be looking at Rita Sharon's article about what it means to think about rendering patients' narratives or stories into writing. I want us to look at the writings by William Carlos Williams, who's probably one of the U.S.'s most famous poets of the 20th century, and who was also a physician, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Then I'm going to have us look at a bit of writing by the book by Susan Quiry about doctors in the making, teaching med students how to do narratives. And then I think I'm going to end by having us look very briefly at that poem by Raymond Carver. I mentioned this outline to you just to sort of show what the trajectory of what our class looks like today, but also to say that there's going to be a kind of well symmetry to sort of bookending, so that we're starting with a poem about a physician and we're ending with a poem about a physician. But the majority of what we're talking about today is what's in the middle, which is what does it mean to think about writings from physicians. But let's start with this one. What does it mean to render into poetry here, to render into words? Words, the value in the life, in this case of a physician. For those of you who aren't familiar with Auden, Auden is probably one of the more famous poets of the first half of the 20th century, one of the leading founders of British modernist poetry. He was a pupil and big fan of Yeats. Auden was also a peer of T.S. Eliot, and whereas T.S. Eliot's poetry tends to have a much more fatalistic or sort of like tragic sort of quality to it in the face of modernism, Auden's poetry tends to have, I think, of a much more sort of sentimental, and not in a bad way, but I mean it has a very emotional sort of component. To that end, Auden is most famous among his many poems for the elegies and the eulogies he's written for persons and individuals, the poem he wrote for Yeats in particular perhaps being his most famous. To that end, this poem that we're looking at today is actually in keeping with some of the work that Auden is most famous for and for what he's best at, which is to say rendering the lives of others, in particular into poetry, and in particular thinking about the value of a life in a span of a few lines of a poem. In this case, it's, as I said, a memoriam for David Protech, who is a doctor, his friend for a long time and physician, and this is called The Art of Healing. Can I get one person to volunteer to read it for us, just the whole thing?
Most patients believe dying is something they do, not their physician. That white-coated sage, never to be imagined, naked or married. Begotten by one, I should know better. Healing, Papa would tell me, is not a science, but the intuitive art of wooing nature. Plants, beasts, may react according to the common, whom of their species, but all humans have prejudices of their own, which can't be foreseen. To some, ill health is a way to be important. Others are stoics, a few fanatics, who won't feel happy until they are cut open. Warned by him to shun the sadist, the nod crafty, and the fee conscious, I knew when we met I had found a consultant who thought as he did. Yourself a victim of medical engineers and their arrogance, when the atom bombed your sick pituitary and overkilled it. Every sickness is a musical problem, so said Novalis. And every cure a musical solution. You knew that also. Not that in my case you heard any shattering, discords to resolve. To date, my organs still seem pretty sure of their self-identity. For my small ailments, you, who were mortally sick, prescribed with success. My major vices, my mad addictions, you left to my own conscience. Was it your very predicament that made me sure I could trust you? If I were dying, to say so, not insult me with soothing fictions. Must diabetics all contend with the nisus of self-destruction? One day you told me, it is only bad temper that keeps me going. But neither anger nor lust nor omnipotent, nor should we even want our friends to be superhuman. Dear David, dead one, rest in peace. Having been what all doctors should be, but few are, and, even when most difficult, can dine of our biased affection and objective praise.
Thank you. All right, there's a lot in this poem, and I'd like just to go through it sort of systematically. Like I said, it works incredibly well as a memorial, but also I think as an assessment, both of friendship and I think also of what we consider to be the standards of not just professionalism, but maybe even the professionalism of an ideal surgeon or physician here. Let's start at the beginning. Stanza one. Most patients believe dying is something they do, not their physician, that white-coated sage, never to be imagined, naked or married. Somebody start with the sentiment we get here at the beginning.
The God image.
Yeah.
It's what?
The God image of being a doctor.
Maybe.
The doctors aren't people.
Not human though.
Yeah, I think it's
like
it
are.
Could be that they're infallible, that's but I think hey, maybe that's because you're a doctor or anything. But it's also the fact that they're not even close to that, you know? Which is to say that we think of this as professionals in general, don't we? We think of them according to their profession, to their career, and their title that they have. We don't often see the fact that they're actually living, breathing people, too. And in the case of the physician, it's especially true that we don't ever imagine them being sick. We don't imagine them dying. This is a memorial being written for a friend, which is hard enough, but let alone given the professional standing of that person, the very person that you come to when you're sick, but never that you think of them the other way. I love this stanza, though, for what it ends on, though, which is never to be imagined naked or married, which is to say it isn't just about illness. It's about this humanity that we tend not to ascribe to physicians, and I think we often do that precisely because we want to think of them as infallible, or we want to think of them as having longevity, or the fact that we don't have to worry about the fact that they, too, can succumb to the illness that we come to them for kind of healing and cure for. But I love this also because it speaks to a theory I have, by the way, about, like, in particular professors and teachers, and I've had this since I was an undergrad. I refer to it as my quesadilla theory. Here's how it works. It works, ready? So if you had a teacher or a boss, or I had this in the case when I had, like, professors in college that I really liked and stuff, but I just never, like, saw them as people. They were just, like, professional. I just couldn't imagine them, like, having, like, friends or just being normal. I was like, yeah, they just, like, I just can't see them being a regular person because I was just nervous around them or what have you. I always refer to it as the quesadilla theory because if I, like, went out to, like, Chili's or something and I saw them eating quesadillas, I'd be like, geez, quesadillas? Or, like, she's a person, you know, that kind of thing. This idea that you think of a person very restricted by your interaction with them professionally, if you will. And this piece is kind of like that. The irony, of course, here is that this is a friend, right? This is his close friend. And yet, it's that title of physician in particular that has in some way impeded, if you will, his consideration that he might have to memorialize or eulogize this individual at some point. We have in stanza two an interesting turn then. He writes, begotten by one I should know better. Healing, Papa would tell me, is not a science, but the intuitive art of wooing nature. Let's start with those first two lines of this stanza. What's being expressed here, then?
My dad's a physician.
My dad was a doctor, and I should know better. Which is to say, it's one thing if I ended up being friends with a physician and later in life and had no experience with that, but I grew up the son of one. And I particularly love the phrase, begotten by one, in the sense that we know where this is lifted from, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Is it the Apostles' Creed, or what is it?
Only begotten.
Begotten, not made.
Yeah.
One in being with the Father, you know, from religion, from Christianity, right? So this idea, and that language comes from going back to God. What is it? Council of Nicaea or Council of Rome or whatever. One of those where the whole idea is that you're supposed to think of Jesus as being partly God, but also the Son of God, and therefore he's not born of God, but begotten by him. Now, there's not the same sentiment being expressed here, but that exact kind of gravity, that exact kind of devotion, holiness, if you will, is what is absolutely being ascribed here to being the son of a physician, begotten by one. You know, in other words, I am the progeny of this particular profession. With a little bit of a nod and a nudge, I think, not unlike Jesus being the Son of God, I'm supposed to have followed in the footsteps of this physician and have not. And yet here I stand now, here I stand, having made the choice to be a poet and not a physician, at the grave of a friend, writing a poem for a physician. Which is to say, that exact kind of lineage, that exact kind of progeny, that the stakes of it are just dripping and endowed with this, the sentiment in this piece, but also the circumstance behind which he's having to write it. So, Papa speaks here. This is the phrase he gets from his father. And it's actually the next three stanzas is what the entire speech is. So I'm just going to read it as though this is what Father would say. So I'm reading it slightly out of order. I'm going to start with line 9 and then jump up to line 8 just so I can read the whole quote in full. So Papa would tell me, healing is not a science but the intuitive art of wooing nature. Plants, beasts may react according to the common whom of their species, but all humans have prejudices of their own which can't be foreseen. To some, ill health is a way to be important. Others are stoics. A few fanatics who won't feel happy until they are cut open. All right, so there's a lot expressed in these three stanzas, this statement from Papa. Let's start with the first sentence he gives us. Healing is not a science, but the intuitive art of wooing nature. Somebody paraphrase that for me. If that's his father's mantra, what's his mantra?
Try and let the body heal itself.
Good. So one way then of the, is the fact that the goal then is not to take mastery over nature or to conquer nature.
It's, way of nature,
it's actually to almost seduce it, right? Manipulate nature, if you will, to some degree. We often think about doctors, physicians, scientists, if you will, as being persons who gain mastery over nature or gain mastery over the body or find a way to usurp what otherwise the natural course of the body or nature might be. And this is not what the father is saying. The father is saying, nope, our job is actually to play into what nature needs to do, to have a better understanding, to dance with as opposed to fight against, if you will, what nature's doing. But then the sentiment changes a little bit slightly from the father, which is to say that first sentence sounds almost like something that would be, you know, a calling card or what would be a really sort of nice sort of like statement, you know. But then we notice that there's actually quite a bit of cynicism that comes from this father, right? By sentence 2 in particular. Mm-hmm. Plants, beasts may react according to the common whom of their species, but all humans have prejudices of their own which can't be foreseen. Which, at the level of a caveat from a physician, is what? If this was being said by a father to a son, most likely in the context of, if you're thinking about if he's a physician, let me tell you a thing or two. What he says is, plants and beasts may react according to the common of their species, but humans have prejudices that can't be foreseen. What does that mean?
I can't predict what's going to happen.
Good. You can't predict how people will be in the clinic, right, or how they'll react. Mm-hmm. In fact, he gives examples now in sentence 3. Some ill health is a way to be important. And that sounds almost exactly like what Susan Sontag said to us in, you know, what you call illness's metaphor, which is to say illness was a way of making people interesting, was what she said. And historically, yeah, it has been a lot of times how that's been their advised, if you will. So he's saying, yep, for some people getting sick just makes them feel important. Number 2, others are stoics. No, I'm fine. You know, they're totally just like going to try to be rough, you know, whether to be a martyr or just to have on a brave face. And 3rd, a few are fanatics who won't be happy until they are cut open. Which is to say, these are people who go to medicine in a panic. They're not stoic. They're also not just trying to make themselves interesting, but they're absolute kind of drama queens, if you will, to some degree. Which is interesting because what actually happens then is that it changes the way we understand that first sentence from the father. Healing is not a science, but the intuitive art of wooing nature. Seems to me that what he's actually saying, given the last two sentences, healing is not a science, but the intuitive art of wooing human nature.
Right.
In other words, your job is absolutely to play into and know what your patients are like. Good, bad, stoic, and crazy. And then just to make sure that they're okay. You know what I mean? Which is to say, the cynicism that's coming from his father is true. He's definitely being like, people are crazy sometimes, patients, right? But it's the fact, and that's why a physician has to be really good with people, or a physician has to be very good at being able to woo what those sentiments, those feelings feelings are. The treatment is going to be the same whether you are the person who wants to be important, the stoic, or the fanatic. If you're sick with the flu, you're going to treat each patient the same in terms of the kind of medicinal care you give. But the kind of TLC is probably going to be very different between the three. So the cynicism that he's seeing here is actually, I would say, better and more described as a kind of savvy that the physician has. And what we're going to see here is that this thing he's ascribing to his father is exactly what he finds in this friend as well. So continuing on, warned by him to shun the sadist, the nod crafty, and the fee conscious, I knew when we met I had found a consultant who thought as he did, yourself a victim of medical engineers and their arrogance, when they atom bombed your sick pituitary and overkilled it. So we have two moments being attached here. The first is when we met and I saw you, that I knew that you had that same spirit my father has, which is to say, you have a mission statement as a physician that shows your love of profession, but you've also got the savvy to be like a little bit like cynical when you need to be about it. So he saw that common bond. And secondly, when you were then sick, I saw that same bravery on you as a patient as well. So the skills that made you a great physician also served you well at the time that you were being atom bombed, if you will, for your sick pituitary. Then we have another quote. This is quote number two. So if you're making a note, you might notice that there's actually three moments, so I think it's right, three moments of quotation. The first is the father. The second here is by Novalis, who's a German like philosopher. So basically what's important to note here is that Novalis is also a pseudonym. I forget what his real name is. It's like Frederick von Wilhelm Gisch something something. But the point is that Novalis is somebody that's oft quoted in poetry or in arts or letters as somebody, you know, the equivalent of like Confucius says, you know, Novalis sometimes says, you know, this is somebody who has great maxims he's very famous for as a philosopher. In fact, his work as a philosopher, I think, has less notoriety for its depth and for its sophistication than it does for its quotability, I might actually say. So this is Novalis being quoted at the level of, here's another maxim with which to ascribe to. So we had the father's lengthy statement, and now here from Novalis, every sickness is a musical problem, and every cure a musical solution. You knew that also. So now we have here a kind of like epigram, this really sort of cute little phrase that thinks about sickness and music. And I want you to think about this, what's being paired up here, because we've already had it set up that begotten of a physician has set up for the speaker here, Auden, as this expectation that he might be a physician, but we know he's not, because we're reading one of his poems here that he's decided to do something else. Having said that, now we see here an allusion that's made a connection between music and sickness, or more importantly, curing sickness and music to some degree. And to that degree, what we have here then is this fusion, if you will, of thinking about illness, medicine, clinical care, the medicinal, as having ascribed to it a kind of artistic quality. Hence the title, The Art of Healing. Which is to say, this poem is going to be important, and we're going to find this as we move through the rest of the piece, is that it purports to be about a eulogy for a physician. It's in the guise of a testament to the life of a man, but it speaks to me so much as a poet writing through his relationship with the physician, and in doing so finding that as the poet is an artist, so the physician is an artist as well. And in many ways, they're doing the same kind of work because they're each doing a certain kind of healing to some degree. This is going to lay the foundation for our discussion today, because what we're talking about today is what does it mean when a physician takes a pen to paper? So it's not Auden as the poet versus Protrek as the physician, but when the physician is actually both people, when he's doing both kinds of healing. Turn the page, if you will, and let's look at the last couple stanzas here. Line 43, not that in my case you heard any shattering discords to resolve. To date, my organs still seem pretty sure of their self-identity. For my small ailments, you, who were mortally sick, prescribed with success. My major vices, my mad addictions, you left to my own conscience. Was it your very predicament that made me sure I could trust you, if I were dying, to say so, not insult me with soothing fictions? What would you say are the two qualities or attributes that are being lionized here in these stanzas?
Who's frank to the point.
Totally, don't bullshit me, absolutely. So this, what you call it, the second one is that he's frank, you don't treat me with kid gloves, you are as good at your profession as you are at sharing with me the details of how good you are at profession, and I respect that and I appreciate that. Good. And what's the first one?
He's not judgmental.
Non-judgmental, absolutely. Which is to say, you are the person who is there for me when I am ill and helps me, but you're not there the person that judges my life or how I feel whether I'm ill or not. Which is to say, then, that there's a kind of good straddling that's happening here between being friend and being physician on his part, and I think he's respecting the ability to be so good at one's profession, but absolutely to know the border of it as well, too. He knows exactly how far to take his role as physician, at least for Auden's comfort level. Moving on now to the last three stanzas. Must diabetics all contend with the nisus to self-destruction? One day you told me, and now we're on to quote number three. So one, quote number one was father, quote number two is Novalis, quote number three is himself. It is only bad temper that keeps me going. But neither anger nor lust or omnipotent, nor should we even want our friends to be superhuman. Dear David, dead one, rest in peace. Having been what all doctors should be, but few are, and, even when most difficult, condign of our biased affection and objective praise. What do you make of the ending of the piece? Emotionally, I guess I'm asking. Well, let's start with that, maybe even just the quote that we get from David here. The first quote is from the father. We hear the quote, and essentially it then stated right after the long three stanza quote, when I met you, I knew you felt the same way. So in other words, it's a quote from the father, but it might as well have been from the guy. And quote number two is a quote from Novalis, a maxim, that ends with, you felt the same way, which is to say, again, in the guise of being a quote from Novalis and actually from the man. This is us quoting David here. It is only bad temper that keeps me going. What do you make of that being the quote that we get from the physician here? In light of the fact that it certainly does not seem to have the quotability factor, maybe, or even the inspirational sort of turn that the other two quotes do. So what's its function, then? It is only bad temper that keeps me going.
I mean, the whole piece is, he's so respectful of him, and it's such a praising speech, and then this kind of quote that you said yourself, it's only my bad temper that keeps me going. I think it kind of... I don't think it necessarily is a comment on his temper more than he really is very ill and he's only holding on with his kind of will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it kind of gave him, just reminded him how sick his friend really was. And then he goes on to say, but neither anger or lust, then he goes on and says like various kind things of him. And so I think he uses this to say, you really were so very sick and I still respect the way that you were later. Like, I don't actually think it's commenting on his personality at that time.
It's actually a really good quote. For, in other words, what kind of person would you say it's only bad temper that keeps me going?
It sounds like he's, like, humbling him. Like, even because his friend's putting him on this pedestal, like, doctors are this, and he's saying, no, look, no,
it's just bad temper.
Yeah. I'm not some, great, person to be like,
I'm not omnipotent or superhuman. Yeah, I'm not indestructible. Great. So somebody with humility would say it is only bad temper that keeps me going versus... I'm just really strong. Yep. Mm-hmm. Fighter, I can do it, Right? No, it's just bad temper keeps me going. So, first of all, somebody who's humble would say that. What's another kind of person that would use that quote?
Funny.
Someone with a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Would you say that quote? And I'm going to go out on a limb and say someone who doesn't have a bad temper is someone
right.
who would say that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that the person who says that is the one who actually can take the piss out of themselves every once in a while, or can be the person who actually has a bit less of a temper or less of a negative side about such things. So to that end, the quote we have here doesn't have the same sort of like... The other quotes seem like they could appear like if you had engraved business cards. On the back there was a quote for your profession as a physician. Anything from those first two columns might sort of work. But this one seems to be something that's a little bit more wry, a little bit more cynical. But how appropriate then that what's being quoted here is actually something that is just so honest and yet so authentic emotionally here. And also something that seems to speak very little towards the pedestal that he's putting him on as a physician, but rather just that sounds like something, I think, as Auden would tell us, that's what David would say. Let's stop here and turn, if you will, to the Rita Sharon article. I want us just to keep in the back of our mind, though, some of the stakes then about what we consider when we think about how we write about physicians. But now we're going to be considering for most of the class then what it means to think about the physician actually having to provide these stories for us. This piece by Rita Sharon dates from 1986. It's one of the first pieces that she wrote. She's one of the leading founders of narrative studies related towards bioethics. She is an MD and a PhD in English. She teaches at Columbia and runs a narrative studies program there, which is co-partnered through the Department of English and the School of Medicine. What I want us to do is look at some of the tenets, the principles of her piece here, where she kind of lays out for us what is significant. Why should we be concerned with narratives, both at the level of storytelling, but also within the clinic itself? Turn to page 60, if you will. I want us to read this whole section, page 60 to 62, where it's called The Process of Dehumanization. And I want to start here because this is sort of the first tenet, if you will, of what Sharon thinks is significant about narrative studies. And I want to start there because it's also the, like, yeah, obvious thing that's good about narrative studies. Like, it helps us to, like, render people more humane and more human, if you will. So, but I want to hear what kind of phrasing is actually used here and the context with which she puts forward these ideas. Can you start with the first paragraph for us, and then we'll just move down until we get to the end of the section?
The student was floored.
Now, this is, page 60, where it has the process of dehumanization.
The process. Yep. The process of dehumanization in medicine has been explored from many directions and has been described as a process affecting both patient and healthcare provider. As I have tried to show by describing Paul's night on call, the experience of caring for patients in a teaching hospital alters patients and doctors fundamentally. Some transformations are obvious, simple, and moderately preventable. Others are more obscure and occur at a level perhaps too deep within the psyche to be changed or even observed.
On the simplest level, people become their bodies. This is the most innocent level of the transformation and applies to healthy people as well as to patients. Should a medical trainee go to a party, he or she will be shown rashes, lumps, and places that hurt. When a medical student is in a crowd, he or she cannot help but scan bared arms. Good vein, I could get a 14 intracath into that one, thanks to the student who spends hours of each day fighting against veins that seem always too small or unruly to accept the catheters for intravenous fluids. At this stage in the transformation, the student or physician becomes a technician and the asexual viewer of bodies.
As the process deepens, the patients are transformed into their organs or diseases. Some medical trainees use this extreme objectification to protect themselves from the need to confront the human tragedy of illness. A malignant hepatoma seems easier to face than a 26-year-old man who will die soon from a rare and fatal liver problem. The trainees shield themselves from the sadness as well as from the fear that they too can become ill. The student or physician is transformed at this stage into an anatomist. Or a curator of specimens. Two medical interns are discussing their patients. The price you pay for one intellectually stimulating patient around here is 100 boring ones that you just have to take care of. And then you begin to resent them. Begin? Who are you kidding? If I want intellectually stimulating work, I'm going to have to go to work with T-cells in the lab.
Do you want us to continue?
Yes.
Not only have patients become diseases here, but some diseases are more equal than others. These two interns have gone beyond the protective manner of depersonalizing their patients because of anxiety or sadness. They've given the patient the responsibility of keeping them supplied with interesting problems to think about. This is a common progression seen among even the most concerned and generous trainees. The responsibility imposed on students and house staff keeps them working, as we all know, for over 100 hours a week, including routine stretches of 36 to 40 hours without sleep. That's not true. The rewards of emotional gratification and satisfaction with accomplishments do not make up for the torment of the work. Furthermore, the trainee needs to learn the cognitive material of medicine. The remaining source of reward, then, is the intellectual one, as the trainee falls back on the hope of at least learning something through the torture. When this hope is denied because all patients have the same diseases, the trainee blames the patients for being boring, withholding the slim and trivial payment of food for thought. The patient then becomes textbook. The student or doctor becomes reader-investigator for the interesting patients and servant for the boring ones.
The next step in the transformation is for the patient to become the agent inflicting pain on the trainee. Patients are not docile, accepting of all tests and procedures. Speakers of the physician's language, tearful and grateful for the care they receive, they're perceived as difficult, hateful, and undeserving of time. From the point of view of the trainee, the difficult patient has hours to a day that has no hours left in it. Such a patient will ensure that the train gets no sleep during the night on call. When a patient gets a fever or drops the blood count or does something else that a patient that requires considerable time, work, and decision making from the student or doctor, the trainee feels it is a personal affront. This is the most dehumanizing step in the process, in which the student or doctor becomes the victim and the patient the punisher. The only step after this one is for the trainee to fight back.
There are many implications about these processes and many more questions to be asked. Does the perceived transformation of one patient affect the status of others being cared for by that physician? How fluid is the movement from one level to another? How universal and how reversible are these transformations?
Great. Okay. So let's go through a few of the things here. The piece starts here with us thinking about what are the different ways in which we dehumanize patients in the clinic or in clinical practice, so that what Sharon is going to propose is that in the face of these potentially dehumanizing variables, setups, if you will, obstacles, we have narrative that can help us to humanize in certain circumstances. The first thing she talks about is in the first three paragraphs here. And this talks a great deal about these anecdotes she gives. When a physician walks in and sees somebody, they can think, look at their veins. I think it'd be really good. They'd be easy to put an IV hooked up to, or thinking about somebody and looking at them and thinking of their symptomology as opposed to their humanity, their personhood, if you will. This is what we talked a bit about when we're talking, I know we were talking about this with disability studies, and we talked about beholding in Rosemary Garland Thompson's article, but this is what Foucault calls the clinical gaze, which is to say it's a kind of perceptivity in which a physician, a clinician, or anybody knowledgeable about anatomy or human biology can look at an individual, in particular within the clinic, because it's the context as much as the knowledge that endows this, and tends to look at the individual as a conglomeration or a composite of symptoms, organs, tissues, features that make up the individual's pathology, but might not actually speak to their humanity, if you will. Now, for Foucault and his argument, it gets to the point then that the physician then sees you and has the potential with which to dehumanize you at the level of maybe objectifying you. And that happens both not just in practice, but also historically in medicine too. So that the history of medicine is such that its earliest roots in ancient medicine, we thought much more holistically. How is your entire body functioning as a whole with which there's a problem? But we've gone more and more and more specific in the history of medicine over the years, and in particular in the last 100 years, so that what we've done then is pathologize at the level of the microscopic, the cellular, the organic, the system, the tissue, so that the gaze then literally gets more specific. So a physician will then be, and appropriately given how the profession is, will come in and be less concerned with the totality of your body. Just think organically here in your body, then show me where it hurts. Is it here? Let's look more specifically at it and let's examine it. Now, Sharon's taking up that example here, and less to propose that there's a kind of dehumanizing way with which physicians just look at patients. Then it just sets up the expectation that we might forget to think about the totality of the person. In this case, she's mostly concerned with the humanity of the individual, their entire story, and more importantly, whether or not we can or can't sympathize with them. For what Sharon is going to lead to after this point is where we tend to blame or ostracize patients. That's almost her concern. Foucault's in the clinical gaze is to say that just how we look at patients says a lot about how much we can objectify or dehumanize them. Point taken. I think Sharon's point is the real worry, though, is if we just make patients feel distant from us or we don't give them the sympathy that we're supposed to. Thus, she gets to all of the variables about how clinical practice is done right now and how it can affect the way that patients are treated. The bottom of page 61, then, has a couple of interesting points. This is where she talks about when students, interns, new physicians in particular, are often working 36 to 40 hours without sleep and having a lot of time with patients. In other words, they're overworked, they're overextended, and that in itself sets up a variable, an obstacle, if you will, from making human connections with patients. But she says interestingly here, and this is about 5 lines from the bottom, these 2 interns that she was talking about in this example, have given the patient the responsibility of keeping them supplied with interesting problems to think about. Turning down to the bottom of the page, the rewards of emotional gratification and satisfaction with accomplishments do not make up for the torment of the work. And then at the bottom, near the end of that paragraph, the trainee blames the patients for being boring and withholding the slim and trivial payment of food for thought. Now here's what's interesting. She's absolutely saying that the way in which clinical practice is done, in particular training of doctors at the level of med school, internships, residency, so on, there's too much work that's happening, but also the fact that there's a way in which we've set up for them that they're overextended, that their skills are being put onto too many things for too long a time that it's hard for them to emotionally invest. But she's saying that the problem with that isn't just the amount of time that's being taken from physicians to do so much work, but it's the way that the expectation is then placed on patients, that they have to in some way carry the weight, bear the responsibility of making their case seem interesting. To that end, doctors aren't just required to work long hours, but they are, to be frank, like any profession, often seeing a lot of the same thing over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, a mechanic, right? Think of another profession, is going to be doing a lot of oil changes and shit, you know? Anybody I know who wants to become a dentist, I always think great for them, but then I always think you're going to be doing a lot of cleaning teeth, you know what I mean? Because jobs are like that. Now the problem with clinical care and the clinic is that when we go to a physician, we're coming obviously with a much more personally invested sort of complaint or concern or need professionally. So this isn't my car needs the oil changed, or even I think I lost a crown, you know, which are both viable concerns. But I'm sick. I might be dying. I need help. What's wrong with me? That sort of thing. But the stakes professionally are no different for a clinician in that you're seeing a lot of the same stuff over and over again. When you add to that this very dilemma she's talking about with people working 30, 40-hour shifts, no sleep, it's just a recipe for how we can make sure that patients might actually feel like they're not being heard or acknowledged, if you will, in terms of themselves. The hard part, though, and the real sadness, I think, for Sharon is that added to all of that stuff is the fact that we then sometimes blame the patient, or at least make the patient feel like we are blaming them if they have a boring case. So it's one thing if your dentist yawns and when he gets ready to change your molar or whatever like that, you know? But who cares, right? In the clinic, though, the stakes are slightly different. Look at the next paragraph, the one that starts the next step in this transformation. This is here now where she talks about not just the patient feeling like it's their responsibility to be interesting towards the physician, but where there might actually be some kind of like ill will or bad blood between patient and doctor just because of the circumstance. This is no way a judgment on these physicians or clinicians. In fact, they're getting the short end of the stick too, because they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, having to work so much time, but also within a profession that requires such a great deal of sensitivity. She says here, patients who therefore come and aren't docile at the level of when they have to administer shots or take care of them or do anything that requires pain are perceived as difficult, hateful, and undeserving of time. Such a patient will ensure that the trainee gets no sleep during the night on call. This trainee feels it as a personal affront, it's stated here. Which is to say, anybody doing a job is going to feel irritated by someone they have to work with or for that's annoying or time-consuming or difficult, you know? That's just life. The hard part is, I think, the responsibility, and I think Sharon would go so far as to say the obligation we have towards people in the clinic as physicians, as nurses, as social workers, as healthcare providers, to know that the stakes may be the same, or the problems may be the same as in other professional contexts, but the stakes are much more different and maybe much deeper when it comes to the clinic. Let's turn, if you will, to the page. Any questions on this so far? Turn to page 65. Like I said, some of this might seem like no-brainer stuff, but I think it's not Sharon's ideas that are the light bulb moment, but rather the way that she articulates and lays them out. So turning on page 65. Where did we leave off, Reed? Mary, I think you're next. This is on page 65, where it starts the act of writing. And we're going to start there, and we're going to read just through the top of 66. I'll tell whoever's turn it is where to stop. This is, by the way, in the section that's called the use of fiction in humanizing medicine. So in setting up this trajectory then, we had a series of factors set out by Sharon that set up how we can potentially dehumanize patients. How we listen to them, how we blame them, how we're overworked, how we forget that the clinic is a place of added sensitivity when it comes to professional attention and awareness. And now she's going to lead us into talking about what writing does to potentially humanize. Take it away, Mary.
The act of writing leads both to empathy and to objectivity. It is experienced to the writer in an oscillation between the two, similar to the oscillation that occurs when a physician or student cares for the patient. The writer, however, can more easily control the oscillation than can the student face with a sick and frustrating patient. They do sometimes.
Yeah.
The writer can use the objectivity as food for the empathy and vice versa, and can experience them not as conflicting, but as dual aspects of the same task. They need not cancel each other out.
When we ask the student to write from the point of view of the patient, we are asking him or her to take on new powers of observation and conjecture. They're asking for an investment in the texture of that patient's life and not in the impact of that patient's existence on the student. When one writes, one sees that patient not in bed clad in institutional Johnny, but at home active living a life. The illness at that point is a minor feature of the picture. The student describes his picture, perhaps without some detail or in taking a history. Does the patient live alone? Does the patient work or go to school? Does the patient keep geckos in the bathtub?
What will the student write? And why will he choose to write this instead of that? Herein lie the powers of fiction. By choosing what to write, the student sees what he thinks about this patient after all. Paul thought of his patient as a spunky old woman who didn't give in without a fight. His feelings of self-protection aroused by her difficulty as a patient overshadowed these protective feelings towards her. But by writing, he perceived the level of strength of this elderly woman. The act of writing removed both of them from the context in which they had become inextricably embroiled in conflict and allowed Paul a prompt new start in perceiving the patient.
Writers know what happens when they create characters. They choose a narrative stance. They choose a voice through which to speak. They play with the distance between themselves and the characters, sometimes merging, sometimes commenting from afar. They let go of the characters and allow them to act. Those with no experience in writing fiction will balk at the suggestion to indulge in the fantasy and the uncertainty of writing stories. Many won't believe that the story will write itself, and that they need only keep up with it. Some will have to tell their stories and have them written for them. All will need permission to take on the power of authorship, to transform some facts about a person's life into a certain born of the author's life.
Thank you. Okay. Turn it back to page 65, if you will. I want to take us through some of the, again, Sharon's value and contribution of her narrative study kind of philosophy isn't that I think she tells us anything that's like, I never thought of that. You know, like, really, listening to patients helps? Wow! You know, it's not that she tells us anything that we didn't get. It's how she phrases it that's so significant, I think. So in the first page here that we just read, on page 65, starting where Mary read, there's several words, I think, that really speak to what I think are the sort of points about narrative. And it speaks semester-long for this class because when you sign up for this class, when you've talked to friends or partners or spouses or lovers or whatever about this class, I'm sure it sounds like this is that the touchy-feely class where it's like, we read stories, you know, and like, you know, we hear about sick people and we feel bad for them, and that's totally true. We do. But the function of it is not just to give us a more humane kind of way with which to think of the clinical. It's absolutely in the service of the clinical that we read these stories. And these are the words that Sharon uses that I think are the right ones to describe why. So the first two words that she uses here are empathy and objectivity. Those are absolutely why we do narratives, why we read narratives, why we share narratives, why we talk about them, because they enhance our empathy and they enhance our objectivity. To that degree, then, the narrative isn't just about touchy-feely, although it is that. It's absolutely about emotional connection. But it's that empathy and objectivity will serve a clinician well, and therefore, then, by God, let's do narratives or just tell stories about it. The second thing she mentions here after those two is in the middle of the paragraph, and the word she uses is control. And I think that is incredibly significant because don't forget, being good at medicine is the intuitive art of wooing nature. It's about being able to manipulate. It's being able to control. It's not about mastering. It's about being able to, as I said, dance with what you need to. And the job of a clinician and physician might be best understood that it's not about having to wrestle the illness from the patient, not having to, as Sontag hates us to do, military metaphor every time, conquer something in the body, but how best collaborate with that body, how best to work with it, to dance with it. And yes, to have better control over it, if you will. Narratives become important then because what they do, and she later talks about this in the powers of fiction she says below, is that in the face of a clinical problem, a pathology, a disease, an illness, an infection of what kind, that a clinician or a medical technician has to in some way be sensitive to and have mastery over, why not start thinking about the story first and the patient? Because as an author, you can have mastery over that, for sure. So part of the purpose then of the narrative is also that the fact that it gets you comfortable in that zone of being able to have a sense of investment and a sense of control over the topics to some degree. Investment is the term that she uses in the second paragraph that we read. And I like that because the word, I think, investment really speaks to me about what is really important, which is to say that the narrative becomes important because there's a sense of kind of ownership, if you will, to some degree. So part of the purpose of telling a story isn't just the touchy-feely thing, and it's not just the empathy and the objectivity and the control, but it's also how responsible, how much of an ownership does one feel over a case is going to be increased if you just take the time to at least think about, write about, talk about, narrativize, if you will, to some degree, the case. That little small gesture might seem like a waste of time, or it might seem like something you're doing for the service of the patient, but you're really doing it in the service of yourself as a professional, because what that's going to do is make you feel a greater sense of ownership. This is why she talks about the powers of fiction. This is kind of the interesting thing I like, which is to say, I'm sure some of you, when you sign up for this class, or like I said, and you're talking to friends about it or what have you, or from the outside, it seems like what we read then is just like stories of people when they were sick, you know? Like, I was sick, and he was sick, and she was sick, and done, right? Which is to say, memoir and autobiography is absolutely part of it, but fiction is important too. So that's why we're reading works of fiction sometimes. That's why we're looking at poetry. And so that the value then here, the case isn't just simply, in order to understand how patients function in the clinic, we need to read real stories of real patients in the clinic. And Rita Sharon's response to that, and I would totally agree with her, is that's a good start. Which is to say, sure, we need to read those narratives, but the importance isn't the fact that they're autobiographical or that they're non-fictional, it's that they're narratives. Stories are where the value are, now whether they're fiction or not, because of the fact that it doesn't have to be non-fiction for me to empathize with it, to help with my objectivity, to make me have investment in a case. And in some case, in lieu of actually knowing every detail about a patient, what she's suggesting is a physician is well served then to think in their head, well, then think fictionally for a while. How can you imagine this case in front of you as a way with which to sympathize? And I'll tell you why that's really important. It comes from an article in Sociology that's kind of a touchstone in history of medicine. The article is by, if you ever want to look it up, Norman Jewson, and it's called The Disappearance of the Sick Man. But the article argues is that the term sick man no longer exists in the history of medicine or in clinical discourse. Which is to say, when people were ill in the past, in particular, before the dawn of the 20th century, we just thought of them as sick individuals. And now, we just think of them as patients. Which is to say that, excuse me, the term patient is always a very loaded one when doing medical studies, medical humanities, or a history of medicine, because it elicits the expectation that a physician has to be around or a clinician has to be in the space for us to even bother to want to look at someone when they're ill. After all, you can be sick as a dog, but you don't become a patient until you actually go to the clinic. So the idea being then that everything all the way up until you see the doctor doesn't matter squat to us. It's only when you become a patient. So the term sick man is the one that tends to be more embraced historically. Jewson's article is that the sick man goes away because we start to focus so much on patients. And his argument isn't just because of the fact that we're prioritizing doctors, it's because we've changed the location of how we do medicine. And he's isolated, three places we do medicine historically. And these are chronological. Bedside medicine, which he thinks is the hallmark leading up to about the 18th century, which leads to hospital medicine, which is to say, hospitals or l'hôpital in France have existed since ancient medicine and were very prominent in medieval medicine, but there were places where one was sequestered or one went to die, or there were places that were part of an extension of charity. And medical practice was done there, but medical practice did not have to be done there. And certainly, if you were going to be trained as a physician, it did not happen at a hospital. That kind of training, that idea of being trained as a clinician happening in a hospital, really comes from about the 18th and very, very late 18th century, as a place where let's now centralize, and let's also institutionalize, excuse me, and let's also make consistent across the board how we train clinicians and physicians, and let's do that then at a hospital. So the idea that you can go to a hospital not just to die and not just to have surgery, but also to be cured, also to give birth to a baby, also to just have a consultation if you're sick or not, and also if you want to be a physician, you also went there too to be trained to become a physician. That's very 18th, 19th, and 20th century. We call hospital medicine. So Jewson is saying, when the transition from bedside medicine, doctors going to your house to visit you, more so towards a centralized location, what Foucault calls, where this book comes from, the book is called The Birth of the Clinic, it's about this exact moment, right? To what now Jewson recognizes as a very 20th century phenomenon, he calls laboratory medicine. Which is to say that now we move towards a place where all of the technical things that are happening related to medicine aren't necessarily just happening in a hospital, they're also being farmed out to a whole bunch of other places. Now Jewson's argument in relation to the disappearance of the sick man is that the power of the patient starts to disappear then, because of the fact that here, clinical consultation is happening where? And which bed in particular? Your house. It is on your turf. Home court advantage, right? So bedside medicine in that early stage, absolutely, this is just a rough sort of trajectory, gives us a sense that there was a greater sense of not just agency, but perhaps even autonomy at times that a patient could have in their care. And therefore, if it was happening at your home, then of course we were much more thinking about a sick man because of the fact there wasn't an expectation of identity based on place. So the hospital changes then now because beds, what you call it, diagnosis and treatment is still happening at bedside, but that bed is actually in a public place and a place that's for clinical care. And then laboratory medicine now changes also because it adds a whole other set of locations. But I like to think of this constellation as significant because for me, if we're trying to think about it at the level of agency and a kind of powerhood and a kind of humanization or dehumanization of the patient, I think about those locations not just in terms of where patients might be or where doctors are or what have you or training happens. I think about it as the trajectory about where diagnosis happens and where diagnosis seems to me to be the significant thing. Because historically, that has meant the interaction between doctor and patient. Is it one that's a two-way conversation? Is it like a negotiation? Or is it just something being pronounced? Well, in this case, diagnosis is happening at your house on your own turf. Here, it's happening in a hospital with the doctor next to you, but nevertheless, you're still there. You could be in a whole different time zone. You could be in a different country than where the diagnosis is going to happen, in some lab, someplace else. So you are nowhere even close to proximity to it. Now, that trajectory I'm giving you just sets up some of the stakes here, I think, that Rita Sharon wants us to think about then, about how we need to be sensitive to and mindful of where a clinician needs to think about their investment, their attachment to a patient. So fiction, ironically, then becomes one of those things, not just autobiography, that allows for us to actually be mindful of compensating for this kind of location or this kind of change that's happening. That turn at the end, then, towards laboratory medicine is really significant, because I think what Sharon is having us recognize, and she says here ever so slightly in these moments, is that what we have then is an expectation and almost an obstacle we have to overcome about the fact that we might not have a kind of proximity with the patient, even when we're in the same room, but often because of the fact that diagnosis and such is happening elsewhere. And this is where fiction comes in, and very important. As a physician, I imagine it's much easier to get to know that patient here. Right? They're on their turf, they're going to be more comfortable, they're going to be themselves. If she's a bitch, she's probably more likely to be a bitch at home. You know, she's just going to, you know, her family's there, her pictures are around. You know, don't you look, she likes Beanie Babies. I mean, whatever, right? Like, you're going to have a, notice a lot more about this patient. Here, it's going to be harder, but you're still going to be with them and you can talk to them. And she's absolutely saying you need to sort of make sure that we listen and talk. But if a great deal of medicine is done here, right? And I'm talking not just a lab across town, or a blood bank someplace in the CDC in Atlanta, but I'm talking about you are my patient, and I help try to make figure out what's wrong with you, but you're over in radiology, and I'm in two rooms over looking at a screen, you know what I mean? Like, there's distances like that. In lieu of not being able to know the actual autobiographical, non-fictional details of your patient, I think Sharon would have us say, make it up. Think of a fiction in your head, because you need to compensate for that. You can't be in the same room with them, sometimes because they're in radiology and you're across the hospital, but sometimes because they're in Bangkok and you're in Philly, you know what I mean? So, like, imagine how you would think of this patient. So fiction then becomes important because of the fact, I think, that obviously knowing the actual details of our patients makes us at least know them better. If they turn out to be terrible people, it might make us like them less, but it gets us to humanize them more and know them better. But we're not always going to have that luxury. And this is why I think fiction actually becomes an important tool in the arsenal, if you will, of how to do these kinds of narrative studies. I want to look at one more moment here before we kick it over to William Carlos Williams. This is on page 71. Okay. Who is reading next? Great. This is on the bottom of page 71 with Let Me Contrast These Models. If you want to take a little look, the two pages before, Sharon is laying out two models of narrative studies that have been done. One is It's Not Sinai, and the second one Ms. Merfant's in a book. I don't know if she says exactly where they teach it. In other words, take a look at it if you want to, but I wanted us to look at the prose where she talks about what she calls the humanities model for how to do narrative studies. Everybody who does narrative studies does it a little bit differently. In fact, I do it quite differently than Rita Sharon. She's absolutely a narrative person. I'm kind of more of a historian sort of person, so I like talking about history and shit like that, right? But this humanities model does seem to be a good sort of assessment of how she thinks about the value of stories having a rather complex, rich sort of look. So let's look at these next three paragraphs. This is with Let Me Contrast.
Let me contrast these models with the humanities model to which my writing work belongs. The humanities model suggests that to teach material from the disciplines of literature, history, philosophy, and language can widen the universe of the medical student and allow for insights and behaviors that are neglected or repressed by the traditional medical curriculum. In light of these disciplines, medical work is seen not only as a diagnostic and therapeutic endeavor, but also as a human interaction addressing moral, emotional, and metaphorical levels of meaning. The skills and methods of humanists complement the skills and methods of scientists. One can argue, for example, that the skills required for a close reading of a literary text or for explication of poetry are akin to the task a physician faces in making sense of a patient's presentation. All these tasks rely on the practitioner's ability to connect seemingly disparate items and to use intuition and understanding of language to recognize patterns of meaning and reference. Medicine practiced without these skills can be mechanic, paternalistic, misguided, and ultimately ineffective.
This model challenges the intent of medical education by placing illness in the context of all human experiences. It suggests that the medical students must be trained to perceive facts and processes in the lives of patients in addition to the pathophysiological ones, and that these data are essential to competent patient care. This model has no stake in the current structure of medical education or in adapting students to its rigors.
Does the study of the humanities humanize medicine? There is currently a healthy controversy about this question. One cannot rely on the study of the humanities to produce compassionate and insightful clinicians in the same way that one cannot rely on the study of science to produce technically competent clinicians. Humanists feel, perhaps appropriately, that they must not overemphasize their potential contribution in this area. I encourage them to accept their rightful place in our curriculum, not because their teaching will humanize students, but because their approach can lead students to deeper experiences with patients, and these experiences alone are the humanizing influences in medicine.
Thank you. Okay, so there's some examples that are made here by Sharon about how methodologically what we do as humanists might be comparable to what one needs to do as a clinician or a scientist. And she talks about skill sets and shit like that, and that's good. But I like the example that she gives here about the fact that, you know, the skill that you need to do what we call close reading, to close read a poem or a story, or like when we were looking at that poem by Auden, we were close reading it. Close reading is looking not just for the literal, but also what's beyond that, not just the liminal, but what's the subliminal. Close reading is also rereading, which is to say, let's take a closer look. Let's revisit that. Let's read it again and see if it gives us a different sort of meaning or interpretation if we look at it. So the skill set that she says that gets employed with that in literary studies is something comparable that happens in diagnosis, I think, in medicine. The way you need to take a closer look or examine or revisit, if you will, a particular moment or a particular place or identity to try to figure out what's going on. I think it's also significant, though, not just as a metaphor. I don't think she's saying, as a literary scholar looks at a poem, so a clinician looks at a lesion. You know, I think that might be true. But I think she's saying it's actually literal. It's not just metaphorical. In other words, as a literary scholar looks at language, so a physician or clinician needs to look at language too. Why did the patient say that? Why did they use that word when they said it? Let me think about that, at least ruminate it on for a bit. I don't have to decipher every intention behind what they said, but by God, I need to close read, if you will, what's being given to me at the level of language. So make a note that what's being talked about here is comparison that's being made that's both metaphorical and literal, and I think it's right on both counts. Now, the second thing she mentions here in this example, in this prose here, is does the study of the humanities humanize medicine? Based on what we just read, what would you say is the answer to that question, or Sharon's answer? Does the study of the humanities humanize medicine?
No.
No? Yes?
There's no guarantee of it.
That's why my answer would be, maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you can't make clinicians necessarily teaching them, or a technician by teaching them the technical.
Absolutely.
But you can hope if you throw it in front of their face that maybe you'll see them.
So she's not so cynical as to say, no. But she's also not so cynical as to say, well, of course it does. You're not so open-minded, you know what I mean? So the point being that I think she phrases that question and answers it with maybe because of the fact that our motivation for teaching the humanities or teaching humanists to doctors is not so that we can make them more humane. That's not the point, because it's not going to work, and that's bullshit. You know what I mean? The reason we teach them this stuff is because it might help them improve their interactions with patients. It might make them better at this. And because that if it might do it, then by God, it should be a part of the curriculum. 90% of what we teach in medical school isn't just stuff that physicians need to know, but it's stuff that will make them do their job better if they use it at some particular point, if they can cling to it or hold on to remember it. So at that point, the humanities, or the being mindful of the humanist side of the patient, should be part of that. In other words, studying the humanities isn't going to make an asshole clinician suddenly a good person. And if that's the threshold, the burden that we have to meet to teach this kind of shit, it's never going to happen. You know what I mean? He's a dick. He's going to be a dick, you know? Whatever. But maybe we can get that dick be better at listening to his patients. You know? I can't make him a likable person, but maybe I can make him a likable physician. You know? And that's the distinction that's being made here. We're not trying to make this a better human. We're trying to make this a better clinician, if we will. And to that degree, what we're trying to really improve then isn't that individual or the patient, but just the interaction that's happening between the two of them. And this is why the storytelling is important. It absolutely is an ownership, it's a mastery, it's an investment, but it's also a connection that gets to happen. And if the clinician is able to take pen to paper, or imagine this as a bit more of a narrative, or say back to a patient their story in some other version, then what it's going to do is enhance that exact connection that's happening there in the service of the patient feeling better, but actually in the service of the clinician doing their job even better as well. The word that Sharon uses in here at one point I think is perfect. It's on page, we just read it a second ago, page 66, where we, that paragraph that enters, writers know what happens when they create characters. And then she makes this connection about how when you create characters, you're making decisions, and she uses the word choose twice. Writers choose a narrative, and they choose voices. And again, this is all showing that when clinicians think of their profession or think of their job to patients and the responsibility as a kind of narrative, then they're actually giving themselves a lot more choices. You think it's about having to let go of power because now you're having to give the patient a narrative, but actually it's making you more powerful because now you have control. And the word she uses at the end of this paragraph is authorship, which is to say that I think what's being suggested here is that the profession of the physician or the clinician and the profession of the author might actually have a great deal in common. It's the exact thrust and sentiment behind that piece by Auden, thinking about his friend David, that actually authorship as a poet and authorship as a clinician are both practicing the art of healing, if you will, to some degree. Sharon has just upped the stakes and asked us to say, well, then in doing your job as a clinician, think about doing it as a kind of authorship, if you will, to some degree. To extend that metaphor, to be an author is to write a text. It's actually to create a narrative, and it's absolutely to disseminate it and to share it with the world. But then guess who's the expert on that book after it's published and disseminated? Yeah. You, the reader. Absolutely. Which is why when we do literary studies or we do narrative studies, our job in reading this poem by W.H. Auden is not to figure out, what did Auden mean? You know, what did he mean when he wrote this poem? Who gives a shit? You know what I mean? It would take me forever because I can't know what he meant by it. The words have to speak for themselves. And the words, what the words say, and where my interpretation meets with it, that's where sort of the power of a narrative is to some degree. If Auden had written a poem, this poem, and then wrote another piece beside it that said, this is what I meant when I wrote The Art of Healing, right? If that was what he meant, if that was the definitive word on what that poem has to say, well then, done. We don't have to teach that poem anymore, right? We have Auden's text that says what he meant. Point of the matter is, not unlike, should we study autobiography and narrative studies and that's it? Should we know what Auden meant when he wrote that poem? That's a good start. But there's a whole shitload more as well. To that end, then, thinking of the clinician as an author is important because that is a kind of ownership that the clinician gets to have, but it also, at the same time, allows a kind of liberty for the patient as well to have ownership over the case, too. Pull out your William Carlos Williams. I want us to look at a couple of things that a clinician has written for us here. And these pieces are great by Williams because he's, in the prose piece I gave you, absolutely just thinking about my job as a writer, my job as a physician. There are many famous writers who actually were clinicians and were trained as doctors. William Carlos Williams and Chekhov. Oh, that helps, actually. Thanks so much. And Chekhov is a famous one as well. Keats was trained as a pharma surgeon and physician. The interesting thing about Williams, though, like Chekhov, was that they were both practicing clinicians their entire lives, too. So Chekhov gave it up for a period of time, but Williams, for certain, was just a doctor his whole entire life. So he was delivering babies and seeing sick kids and, you know, helping cure colic and shit like that his whole life, you know? So to that end, he never forewent or let go of his job as a clinician in the service of his job as an author, or vice versa. The significant thing, too, is that William Cross was quite famous during his lifetime. So this is not like an Emily Dickinson thing where he wrote a whole bunch of poems and he died and they found a, you know, box in his office that had all these poems in it. I mean, this was a man who was very famous, traveled, friends with Ezra Pound and a number of other famous authors, but he was still just like the GP family doctor, you know, to a bunch of people. So Williams, like I said, was from this area, went to med school at Penn, and then practiced medicine for most of his life in this part of Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. And most of the patients he saw were part of family practice, a lot of kids, so pediatrician, and he did a lot of births, childbirths as well. So sort of a catch-all, sort of like family, sort of practice, sort of doctor, if you will. Now, having said that, he was a very good clinician, went to one of the best medical schools here, and also was very well regarded in this regionally as a physician and a clinician. Having said that, his regard as a poet was unrivaled. By the later part of his life, he was certainly seen as one of the great geniuses of poetry of the 20th century. But that degree of acclaim in poetry did not in any way detract from his commitment to being a physician. And I think some of the phrasing he uses here, and he talks about his writing and his job as a doctor, show that that's because they sort of went hand in hand, I think, for him and how he thought about his identity and the kind of healing and the kind of scrutiny that I think he saw in himself as a poet and also as a clinician. Turning to page 120, I'm going to read two paragraphs here. This is the bottom of the middle of 120. More than once we have all seen ourselves rejected, seen some hard-pressed mother or husband go to some other advisor when we know that the advice we have given him has been correct. This is the we here as we clinicians. That too is part of the game. But in general it is the rest, the peace of mind that comes from adopting the patient's condition as one's own to be struggled with toward a solution during those few minutes, or that hour, or those trying days when we are searching for causes, trying to relate this to that to build a reasonable basis for action, which really gives us our peace. As I say, often, after I have gone into my office harassed by personal perplexities of whatever sort, fatigued physically and mentally, after 2 hours of intense application to the work, I came out of the finish completely rested, and I mean rested, ready to smile and to laugh as if the day were just starting. That is why, as a writer, I have never felt that medicine interfered with me, but rather that it was my very food and drink, the very thing which made it possible for me to write. Was I not interested in man? There the thing was, right in front of me. I could touch it, smell it. It was myself, naked, just as it was, without a lie telling itself to me in its own terms. Oh, I knew it wasn't for the most part giving me anything very profound, but it was giving me terms, basic terms with which I could spell out matters as profound as I cared to think of. How would you describe what's being shared here then by Williams? There's a couple sentiments sort of tucked in here. Let's start with the first paragraph, when he says, more than once we've seen ourselves rejected, when a patient basically gets our diagnosis, and we know it's the right one, but they decide, I'm going to get a second opinion, and we feel a bit sort of dejected, like, but I know I could help you, and I have the right thing to say to you. So there's that kind of dejection. What's the other dejection he mentions in here? I think it's just about exhaustion, right? Mm-hmm. Fatigue. Mm-hmm. So what's the writing do then?
Nourishes.
How?
Inspires, fulfills, fills a gap that's there that they can't fill any other way.
Good. So it inspires, it provides a supplement, if you will, to what's a gap, as you said, that needs to be fulfilled, if you will, in some degree. What else?
Lets them work through emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a tool, too, that helps them work through things, helps them come to a kind of solution, if you will. In other words, it almost sounds like it's talking about when I go into my office space and close the door and think and write and try to put pen to paper, what have you, it actually helps me sort out the dilemmas and the problems that I might have. Narrative, in other words, can be also not just a means, I mean, an end, but also a means towards an end. It can be the vehicle that gets one towards the solution. And it's rejuvenating, I think he says here, then, in some degree. Which is to say, the paragraph starts with the feeling of dejection, unsuccessfulness, if you will, only to end the paragraph with talking about bounding out of your office as though the day is just starting. And the way it does is because the narrative part, the thinking, if you will, about a narrative, is actually providing a kind of success, if you will. It's providing fuel for the fire. This is a bit what Sharon was talking about, too, that in the face of having to know that your job is to seduce, you know, nature, if you will, or work with what that's in front of you, having a narrative or thinking as a writer might actually give one greater control, greater ownership, greater authorship, and greater mastery of the very thing. So when one feels depleted, you do think, oh, do I have to write a story about this now or think about it as a narrative? I don't have any energy in me. The irony is that in some cases it might actually be that it's the thing that does rejuvenate. And it might just be one of those cases, like, I'll give you an example. I always talk about this when I think back, and I kind of longingly look back when I was in high school and I was, like, having to do, like, AP English and then calculus and stuff like that, right? So now I just do English and history and shit, so it's all the same kind of stuff. But I can remember when I was in high school, and I'd be, like, working, like, for an hour, like, doing English work, what have you, and just being, like, I'm so tired. I just don't think I can do anything else. And then I just pull out my calculus book, and you could literally feel yourself using a different part of your brain. Have you ever had that experience where you've totally shifted tasks, you know? Or if you're like totally tired of grading papers or writing notes or filling out paperwork or what have you, and then you decide, okay, let's just do dishes, you know? And suddenly you have a little bit more energy or something. That shifting gear. I think narrative and writing might be a good way to think about the way that it actually then can be a supplementary in a good way towards the practice that a clinician has to do. A clinician has to do, so for all the commonalities we have to find between how narrative is like medicine, you know, reading a book is like reading a, you know, thermometer or whatever shit, right? The fact of the matter is that one of the great things about narrative is that it is so different than what a lot of the skill set a clinician has to use. So that shifting of gears might actually be the very sentiment that I think Williams is tapping into about how it can be rejuvenating. I'm still thinking about my patient, but I'm absolutely doing it with a different part of my brain. And therefore, suddenly I've got a lot more energy to tap into in the service of that very same task I have, which is to be a good doctor. Now, the second paragraph he mentions here is now in the abstract about this idea that I've never really seen being a writer as that different than being, you know, what I have to do in medicine. And he talks about how interesting the cases are, and really the greatest thing about being a doctor when you're a poet is, like, it just gives you all the stuff to write about, you know? It's, like, perfect for it. So the irony of this paragraph, and I love this paragraph, by the way, because basically Sharon's argument is the fact that teaching doctors to be writers might make them better and can have the potential to make them better, and so let's do it. This paragraph basically says teaching poets to be doctors might actually make them better poets, if you will. So the fact of the matter is, like, we don't have the luxury of being able to, like, teach a writer how to be a clinician, but we do have the luxury of teaching the clinician how to be a writer a little bit. And to that end, how lucky clinicians are to be able to do that, and therefore we should encourage it at any turn. Turn, if you will, to page 123. I want to just direct you to a couple of lines that Williams has here, and then I want to just turn the page and have us look at something else. He mentions that on the top of 123, the paragraph that ends, you know you want to be a successful writer. This sort of chit-chat, the daily practice of medicine, tends drastically to cure. And then he mentions in the next paragraph, with a desire to speak. He's talking so much here about then that in the face of clinical practice, he finds that there are so many things that happen, so many events in the course of the day that actually inspire one to want to write. He mentions an anecdote about reading the paper and seeing all these tragic stories, and one feels like, oh, geez, right? But in life, he encounters those same stakes, those same tragedies in his profession. And the ironic thing is, what seems hard to read sometimes in the paper of the harshness of life, I know my profession is dealing with things that are that serious, good news and bad news. And putting them into words actually helps to some degree, because it's not just cathartic, but actually because it actually gives a sense of that's how important. How sad it is when you read the paper in the morning and see that someone died and it made the front page of the paper. Not sad that it made the front page of the paper, but in my job I see people die every day and they don't make the front page of the paper. No one writes about them. Williams is almost saying, when I sit down to write about them, I don't feel as bad anymore. Someone needs to do that job. And I think he's showing that as a clinician, your job is absolutely to be there for the patient and absolutely to try to heal them and make them better. But your job might also be, too, that to give them the sense of gravity and significance that their case warrants. And sometimes that also includes writing about it, if you will. Now, as we know from this class, writing about it doesn't mean like, oh, great, I got to write a biography about every patient I've ever had. It means hear their story, say it back to them, make a note in their chart, have some sort of reference to it in your diary if you're thinking about it, talk about it with a friend. Rendering into words to prose sometimes means pen to page or fingers to keyboard, but a lot of times it just means language and thought about a particular case. And I think his example, of course, is the most extended. He's a professional writer and professional doctor. What I want you to look at, though, is on page 124. I just want to direct you towards these two paragraphs before we look at a poem as his. This is on page 124. It's the paragraph that starts, "What is the use of reading the common news of the day, the tragic deaths and abuses, etc., etc.?" Look at that poem, that paragraph, if you have a chance, and sort of reiterate some of the points I've just made. And in particular, how it segues into, do we not, this is the next paragraph, do we not see that we are inarticulate? This is what defeats us. In other words, for Williams, and I think this is something that Sharon might also be mindful of in other writings of hers, is that the point of the narrative isn't just to render that story into words on a page. It's also to help the physician increase that sense of articulateness that comes also with the case. So there's a very basic, almost linguistic, if you will, sort of motivation for why narrative, both as an act of reading and as an act of writing, absolutely enhances and supports the roles that a physician plays. If I could get you to turn, though, the page to a poem he wrote called The Birth. I'm going to read out loud to you, actually, a paragraph that's from the piece just before The Practice, this autobiographical piece he wrote. And it's on page 125, if you want to circle it. It's the first complete paragraph on 125. But as I'm reading it, just listen. Because what's going to be articulated here by Williams is this sense of authorship, the sense of ownership, that really what a clinician needs to think about with their cases. And how it's talked about is how language occasions or makes possible, narratives in particular, a greater sense of that exact kind of ownership. And the metaphor that's being used here is a kind of parentage, or parenthood, birthing, if you will, that a narrative makes possible. We're going to look at this poem that he wrote called The Birth, but this is the paragraph he writes that sort of creates a metaphorical sort of connection. "The physician enjoys a wonderful opportunity, actually, to witness the words being born. Their actual colors and shapes are laid before him, carrying their tiny burdens, which he is privileged to take into his care with their unspoiled newness. He may see the difficulty with which they have been born and what they are destined to do. No one else is present but the speaker and ourselves. We have been the word's very parents. Nothing is more moving." And this is that instance that I was talking about, where is there a dialogue? Is there a connection that's happening between physician and patient? Whether it's in the bedside, whether it's in the hospital, or whether it's in a chart that might be between patient and physician to some degree. The scrutiny that needs to happen close reading isn't just metaphorical, I said, it's literal. What did the patient say? Why did they mean that? So the stakes with which Williams is arguing that we need to think about telling stories, putting into words clinical care and how they do these narratives, is also reciprocal to what the patient is saying. You are a witness, privileged, not just to take care of this person's body, but to hear their words. So listen, be attentive, and therefore know that you have a great responsibility and great privilege to give words back to them to some degree. So to that end, what's happening is this birth that's being mentioned here. He says, there's nobody else present, just the speaker and you, when a patient is talking about their health. So you get to witness this case being rendered into language. And just as this patient comes to you with their body, they're the stuff, materially, they come to you, and they're handing it over to you, take care of me. So they're doing it with their words, too. Here are the words that explain my case and my condition. Your job, then, is the same. Give them back to them. Better, more understood, more sound. In most cases, it's the patient coming in, right, and saying, hurt elbow, nausea, headache, bicycle, fell down last week. They tell you a bunch of facts, and you say back to them, sprained ankle, pneumonia, some sort of diagnosis that comes from the conditions, the ailments that they come to you with. But I think it's also the case in just what the story, what the narrative is. The patient comes to you with some description of who they are, what ailment is they're having, what they need, and then your job is to speak back to them. I mean, at the most basic level, the demand here, the call is, don't forget to speak back to them in a way that's like a narrative, too. Because that reciprocity is absolutely your responsibility, too. Let's look at this poem, then, The Birth. This is on page 127. I'm just going to read this all the way through. And I want us to think about what perspective is being set up here by Williams as a clinician, but also Williams as a poet, too. This is the birth. A 40-odd-year-old para, Tenavara, or Nevada, she didn't know, uncomplaining in the little room where we had been working all night long, dozing off by 10 or 15-minute intervals, her great pendulous belly marked by contraction rings under the skin. No progress. It was restfully quiet, approaching dawn on Guinea Hill in those days. "What's a ma, Doc? I don't want to come." That finally roused me. I got me a strong sheet, wrapped it tight around her belly. When the pain seized her again, the direction was changed, not against her own backbone, but downward toward the exit. It began to move. Stupid not to have thought of that earlier. Finally, without a cry out of her, more than a low animal moaning, the head emerged up to the neck. It took its own time rotating. I thought of a good joke about an infant at that moment of its career and smiled to myself quietly behind my mask. I am a feminist. After a while, I was able to extract the shoulders, one at a time, a tight fit. Madonna, 13 and a half pounds. Not a man among us can have equaled that. That's a big baby. All right. Let's start with the poem at its beginning then. What's the scenario? Where are we?
The living room.
We're in the little room.
Birthing room.
The living room.
Where do we think it is? Mm. A delivery room? Mm. A house?
Maybe.
A clinic? Yeah, I'm not sure where we are. Like I said, Williams did a lot of home visits. I mean, he was your family practice GP kind of guy, so it probably isn't University of Pennsylvania Hospital.
Right?
Right? And the fact that it's called a little room, I don't know, that the fact that it's diminutive makes me think that it might be someplace awkward, which is to say, it's described by the fact that it's small, which is to say, as though he is consciously aware of the fact that this is really not conducive for birthing, this room, what have you. So we sort of ended up in this little room. Whether it's at her house, whether it's at his clinic, whether it's a really bad sitcom where they always have people give birth in cars. Don't they always do that? And, yeah, right? That always happens like about season 3. We gotta think of something, right? Deliver a baby, right? So we don't know where it is exactly, but it's definitely someplace that seems to be rendered slightly atypical. And of course, we also have a feeling that it's probably someplace that speaks a bit towards class, maybe, if not poverty, at least not so much to affluence. And of course, the speaker who we have here, the mother who's birthing, and her speech also speaks to the fact that what we might be dealing with here is somebody who's not as educated as he is, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we know here that this is one of those cases where 10 or 15 minute intervals, be working for hours. This is the exact scenario that Sharon was setting up for us, with a clinician being overextended. Now, he's not an internist at a hospital, but he's absolutely somebody who probably you would think would be the last thing he's interested in is telling a story about this. But we know that's not true for two reasons. One, he writes a poem later, and two, in the middle of the birth, he tells himself a joke, right? So we do know that actually taking a diversion from a clinical case at hand is absolutely things that a clinician might be mindful to do. And this is sort of the case with Williams. Now, we have the mother that says here, "Was a ma, doc? You don't want to come." Now, the patient says this, and what happens after that?
He kind of realizes that there might be a problem. Like, oh,
brainstorm.
He kind of figures out a way to do it.
He figures out. He figures out the solution, right? He knows it's been protracted and it's not coming and the baby blah, blah. But then he hears the mother make this statement. Unrelated, by the way, right? There's nothing in the mother's statement that makes me think bedsheet, you know, or whatever, right? It's just something she said. But it's an interesting scenario then. So that we've talked a lot about the way in which patients and doctors and the communication that needs to happen, the reciprocity, maybe the language that comes and needs to be given back. But the basic scenario here is a woman, legs in the air, birth and ready to go, right? Sweating and they're both tired. And she says something to him, something sort of just sort of like off the cuff, unrelated, so to speak, right, to the solution. And his reaction is to do what? Basically does the Scooby-Doo thing. Right? Go! Solution, right? So off he goes and gets a bed sheet and gets all the stuff he has to do, right? He's not talking back to her, right? I mean, it's interesting that we don't see here, then, any comment back. And I don't think that's because Williams is an asshole or because he didn't say anything. It's just not in the poem. But it does show, then, that what's being said by the patient, unrelated as it might be, has actually prompted from him some kind of reaction. In this case, happens to be the solution that's happened. And the solution is the direction was changed, not against her backbone, but downward. Where is this part with it? We got a sheet and wrapped it tight around her belly. I mean, it almost sounds like he's doing, like, squeezing the toothpaste out of the tube, doesn't it? Right? Right? Which is why I like that he's so stupid. I thought of that earlier. You know what I mean? How do you get a baby out of there? How about push it out? Right? So now then he says, finally without a cry out of her. So now she's not crying. And these aren't also words either, so there's no quotation. More than a low animal moaning. So it's akin to that sound. The head emerged up to the neck. It took its own time rotating. Now here's interesting. I thought of a good joke about an infant at that moment of its career and smiled to myself behind my mask. I'm a feminist. This whole scenario here, starting with finally without a cry, is hard because we're starting to recognize now, is this the image of the clinician in writing this poem or in being present in that scenario of him being more human or inhuman? Sharon's terms are, do we humanize or dehumanize the patient? What is happening here? Finally, without a cry out of her, more than a low moaning animal. Well, now he's, first of all, he hadn't responded to her, just ran off. Now he's almost making her akin to an animal. Humanize, dehumanize. I'm apt to think it might dehumanize a little bit, you know, to describe your patient as sounding like a moaning animal. So that's one thing. And then it says, then the head emerged up to the neck. It took its own time rotating. And now this fetus, this baby that's about to be born, right, mm-hmm. who's also under the patient's care, I mean the doctor's care, is now being referred to as it, and the head rotated at its own sort of like turn, right? So again, humanizing, dehumanizing. Well, kind of, this is that clinical gaze, I think, that's sort of happening, right? And then, I thought of a good joke about an infant at that moment of its career and smiled to myself quietly behind my mask. Again, humanizing, dehumanizing, right? What a dick, right? I mean, it seems like such an insensitive thing to do after all of this. First of all, he's treated like a tube of toothpaste, right? Now he's thinking about the baby that's just kind of coming and taking its own time, right? And then he thinks about a joke. Meanwhile, she's probably sweating up a storm. The only thing we know she said is, it doesn't want to come. I don't want to be a ma, you know? Like, she sounds in distress. But then he says, I am a feminist. What does that mean? Why does that line?
A joke at that point in time.
Well, and the
I'm
sentiment.
His mother,
it was like
self-filtering.
It's what?
It was self-filtering. Like, I think he caught himself being sort of insensitive.
That
and
not,
yeah.
That is not what I thought when you read that part of it. And I was like, what? No mm-hmm. way. But then I think it was sort of recentering, sort yeah. of, that's not who I am here.
I am a feminist, I think, is. It's both true and not true. I think it's a chastisement to the self, like, I'm a feminist, I need to knock this off or something, right? Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, it's taking the joke that he was thinking about himself, that he was chuckling, and then being like, I'm a real feminist, aren't I, right? Right. Which is to say that it's both ironic and not. And the point of it, I think, is those things that he's doing before, the distance with which he's creating with the patient, the way he may be objectifying the patient, the way in which he has the insensitivity which to have a chuckle or a laugh, one, makes him more human, right? He's just a person as a clinician, right? But that catching of himself, that even slight chastisement, I think, makes us realize that the poem isn't about the birth. It's about what his attitude was as a witness to that birth. And how actually what's being seen here is a kind of assessment of himself in the process. So he's letting us see him, warts and all, what was happening in the process. He actually did a great job as a clinician. The baby came out just fine. And biggest baby I ever delivered, you know what I mean? Like, it's going to be a story he tells forever, right? But it's also a story that might have some unsuccesses in it, too. And he gives us all of those. And the real success isn't that the baby came out and that it was big, or the fact that he shares unsuccessful things, that he did a poem about it, I think, and shared that with the world. And it's the documentation of that that actually might be the greatest sort of learning tool from it. Thus the ending, after a while I was able to extract the shoulders one at a time, Madonna, 13 and a half pounds, which is big ass baby. And then, not a man among us can have equaled that.
For sure.
And that is a total, this is a classic, like, if he seems like a chauvinist, if he seems like a pig, if he seems like not a feminist, this is the look what a woman can do.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? But that's also look what a woman can do versus she's the hero in this room, not the clinician who did this. I was lucky to have been a part of it. Now, given his sentiment that he said before about the privilege that we have to hear the words from the patient, we are the parent to those words. We get to see their birth. Then, she gave birth to the baby. I gave birth to the birth, which is the poem that came out of that scene. And that kind of ownership allowed me to have more of a connection with that patient. if I was doing a disservice to her by chuckling while she was doing the baby or being a bit overtired or exhausted, the exact same scenario Rita Sharon Wakens, when I started to think about this as a narrative, when I actually now put it into narrative as a poem, that's when I was making the most service to my patient to some degree. And we don't all have to be as good as William Carlos Williams to do that, but it's the exact same kind of formula I think that's played out for us. I'm going to direct you towards just a couple of things before we close. First, I want to direct you to two paragraphs in this piece by Susan Pryory. Suzanne is one of the sort of founding editors, I believe, of Medicine and Literature, which is where the Rita Sharon piece comes from. What I want you to do is just look, for your own interest more than anything, how do medical practices and how do some of the teaching of medical narratives happen? Now, this article by Rita Sharon I mentioned is from 1986. This book by Suzanne Pryory is from 2010. It literally came out less than a year ago. And what I want you to do is direct you towards a couple of suggestions that she has for how to teach doctors and how to teach them to be better at narratives and some of the programs that are out there. And what you'll find, if you haven't read the article yet, is it's almost the same thing Rita Sharon said in 1986. And that's not a bad thing because it says two things. What Rita Sharon laid out in the framework still holds true. It wasn't specific to 1986, you know. It's just what we need to be mindful of in clinical practice. And two, it also shows that we still need to remind clinicians, remind people working in medicine, they need to be doing this. So one, the stakes have remained the same, and they always will. And the need for it in medicine has remained the same, and probably always will. So there will probably be a book another 20 years from now that sort of restates some of those things. What this article is good at, what this book is good at, is now saying, if Rita Sharon showed us two programs, one at Mount Sinai and one in another book, and then she talked about her humanist model, this book now sort of updates with what new things are. So on page 158 to 159, Suzanne mentions a couple of statistics related from the Association of American Medical Colleges, how often they integrate narrative studies in classes so far, if you just want to take a look at some of the numbers for how many faculty they're doing or how many hours in the course of the four-year undergrad. And then also on page 159, there's some projects and groups that are some samples that she mentions for possible ways in which narratives are now taught. The article continues to go on and talk about a few different examples of narrative studies. I would ask you now, just at your own speed, to take a look on page 166. Again, this is totally for those who are interested to see how medical teaching of narrative has been implemented, and in the case of what this book is also saying, how it needs to continue to be improved. Pages 166 to 168 are a good description of how some of that medicine is being done. Like I said, it'd be interesting if you haven't read it yet to take a look and see how much is actually very similar to what Rita Sharon was outlining in 1986. What I want to do, though, is end now by turning to this poem by Raymond Carver called What the Doctor Said. It's from that book, A Life in Medicine. It's just a one-page poem. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read this poem out loud. I want to say a few words about it before I read it, but I think we're just going to end after I read it. And what I want to say, though, is to think about where we started with the Auden piece, thinking about the friend in memoriam, that how to render into words what a physician means to you is actually to realize that a physician is doing that exact same work that you're doing by rendering things into words, which is to say that it's the exact same thing that we've found in terms of thinking about what does it mean then for a physician who needs to use words in talking to a patient, in writing a case, in telling a story, in creating some sort of a connection and a greater ownership with a case before him. This piece by Raymond Carver, and if you don't know Raymond Carver, he's a very famous short story writer from the second part of the 20th century in America. Very famous for writing stories of urban life, working class, all different kinds of professions, intersections that are happening between different sort of stories of persons living in cities. Raymond Carver had a lot of jobs working in blue collar before he became a writer, then went on to be a famous writer and teacher of writing. So he writes a lot about that disparity of class and culture. He had a large drinking problem for a number of years, so writes a lot about those sort of narratives. This piece is where he also talks a lot about doctors. He has a long history in his past working in hospitals as everything from a custodian all the way up to a technician, sort of as part of his career. So they are the fodder also for a lot of the stuff he writes. But he himself is not a clinician. Why I love this piece, though, is that it sets up for us, and this is why I just sort of want to read it, sort of stop after reading it, with the exact same stakes that are consistent throughout all of the things we've read today that are the central piece of that Chekhov story, if you had a chance to read it, but what I think are absolutely essential in terms of what we need to think about narrative studies. Narrative studies, not just what a clinician needs to say about a patient, what a patient has to say or feels that they must say when they go into to a clinic. To that end, it is this very thing I was talking to you about, the privilege you have as a clinician to be able to hear words that come from a patient, and the absolute responsibility you thus have to treat them, to return them back to the patient with something wonderful. I'll give you an example. There's a very famous scholar in bioethics and history of medicine. Her name is Alice Drager, and she focuses on intersex studies. And she does a lot of work right now in her own spare time where she speaks with people who have children with hyperplasia or intersexism or have any kind of genital or birth defects. And she has them come to her, and they tell her basically their story. When they were 14, this happened and that, and blah, blah, blah. And what she does as a historian is writes a three-page document for them that says, this is the history of your condition, this is what happened historically and how it turns out, and when you were 13, this is what happened to you, and this is how your life is informed by the history of what this illness was. And she just gives them back this piece of writing. It doesn't get published, it doesn't go anywhere else, but it's supposed to render into words. In her case, she's not a clinician, she's a historian, but she's doing the exact same thing, which she's using her profession and her skill set and a narrative with which to return something to a patient. So too clinicians, and so too patients when we go into the clinic. That privileged connection, that sharing of words, is absolutely what narrative is for. Narrative is the touchy-feely thing about us making to know patients better, but that's just the start. It's really us saying the words are very important. So I want to be mindful of those words I get, and I want to be a part of those words that go back to the patient, because it's a privilege to be able to do that. Thus, we have this poem by Raymond Carver called What the Doctor Said, and it's about 20 lines, and all it is this is what he said, and this is what I said, and this is what he said, and this is what I said. This is bare bones, that exact level of what the words are. What the doctor said. He said it doesn't look good, and he said it looks bad, in fact, real bad. He said I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting them. I said, I'm glad I wouldn't want to know about any more being there than that. He said, are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help when you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms? Do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments? I said, not yet, but I intend to start today. He said, I'm real sorry. He said, I wish I had some other kind of news to give you. I said, amen. And he said something else I didn't catch, and not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, and me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. It was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, habit being so strong. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. Have a great week. I'll see you next week.